hard-hitting medical truth, cutting through conflict and confusion to the understanding you're searching for. Join Dr. Peter McCullough, world-renowned medical expert and practicing physician, for this edition of the McCullough Report. Your life may depend on it.
Let's get real. Let's get loud. On America Out Loud Talk Radio, this is a McCullough Report. I'm Dr. Peter McCullough. Wow, do we have a show for you. So many things are popping right now out there on social media, mainstream media. It's pouring in at this point in time. And I have to tell you, many think capitulation is around the corner now on the COVID-19 vaccine debacle. But let's just bring you right in. Here's an interview just came out between Tucker Carlson and the founder of the Vaccine Safety Research Foundation, Steve Kirsch, who's someone who's been very outspoken regarding the COVID-19 vaccines. Kirsch took the vaccines himself, realized how dangerous they were later on, and he cannot be still about this. Let's listen to Tucker and Kirsch.
The lies we were told about the COVID vax were so grotesque and so overwhelming that it's almost hard to watch them just 2 years later. But we should, because the people who told them are still effectively in charge. Here's one. It's from 2021. This is CDC Director Rochelle Walensky telling us, informing us, that anyone who takes the vax and then somehow manages to get infected, but that would never happen. But if it did happen, that person would not be able to spread the virus to anyone else. We promise. Watch.
Can you, if you were to get infection with and vaccinated, could you give it to somebody else? Were you silently able to spread it? Those data were not covered in the clinical trials, but now data have emerged again that have demonstrated that even if you were to get infected during post-vaccination, that you can't give it to anyone else.
Why hasn't she been charged with a crime? Well, she never will be. And of course, just a few years later, it turns out the whole thing was a disaster of world historic proportions. Books will be written about this at some point when we can tell the truth about it. A lot of people were killed or permanently disabled by it. How many is the question? How many people were hurt by the vax? How many people were killed by the vax that was mandatory? Well, we just spoke to Brett Weinstein on this show, Professor Brett Weinstein. He told us he's seen research up to 17 million people across the globe may have died from it. Watch.
I was recently at a conference in Romania on the COVID crisis. And so there was a lot of work trying to unpack what we actually understand. And I saw a credible estimate of something like 17 million deaths globally from this technology. So
17 million deaths from the COVID vax?
Well, when you scale up to billions, it's not hard to reach a number like that with a technology this dangerous. Now, to your deeper question, I think let's steel man.
So just for perspective, I mean, that's like the death toll of a global war.
Yes, absolutely. This is a great tragedy of history. So that proportion.
17 million globally. Now, that's an estimate. And the interesting and most shocking fact, actually, is that we don't really know because no one seems to be keeping track, at least in this country, which is amazing considering what our government keeps track of. The Biden administration knows exactly how many transgender heart surgeons there are, how many bisexual Samoan airline pilots. They keep track of it with Nazi-like precision. But how many people were killed or disabled by the COVID vax? They don't care, so they're not keeping track of those numbers. So it falls to people who don't work for the U.S. government. One of them is a man called Steve Kirsch, who is a MIT-trained inventor, by the way, a longtime donor to the Democratic Party, not a lifelong right-wing extremist or anything, a businessman. But he has now dedicated his time and his ample energy to figuring out exactly what the COVID vax did to this country and the world. He's the founder of the COVID-19 Early Treatment Fund. Steve Kirsch joins us now. Steve, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you, Tucker. It's great to be here.
So before you tell us what you found, and you've been working on this, it seems to me, day and night for a couple of years, tell us your background, because you don't have a background in public health. It's sort of a weird life trajectory that you've had, which I think makes the story more compelling. How did you get to where you are now, to doing this?
Well, As a young kid, I had a summer school probability course when I was in high school, and that was just really game changing for me. I was fascinated by math and just really excelled in math. And I went to MIT, got a couple of degrees from MIT, left MIT, started about seven different high tech companies, a couple of $1 billion, a couple of them had $1 billion market caps. And then what happened is COVID essentially closed my business in that we couldn't go into work. And so I was looking to do whatever I could to make a difference so that I could go back to work and everybody else could as well. And so I started looking at early treatments and started the COVID-19 Early Treatment Fund, raised about $5 million. And we funded research on drugs like fluvoxamine, which was featured on 60 Minutes. And then there was, of course, this work on the vaccine in the background, and we were all very hopeful that the vaccine would be successful.
Yes.
And so it came out, and the FDA said that they have tested it, and it's totally safe, and everybody should get it. It uses this new novel technology. And, of course, I'm a technologist, so I'm always looking for something that's new, better technology. And so they said, super safe, everybody should get it. And I said, look, even though that I knew about early treatments and I knew that fluvoxamine was effective in reducing long-haul COVID, and if you got it early, people didn't seem to suffer from COVID. Even though I had that, I said, why don't I get an extra protection? So I myself was vaccinated in March of 2021. And I got two shots of Moderna. And then about a month later, I started hearing horror stories from my friends. I heard from one person who had three relatives who were perfectly healthy, and all three of them died a week after they got the vaccine. And I said to her, well, I said, that's impossible. That's statistically, like, so unlikely that it could never happen if it was caused by the vaccine. And she said, yeah, but they're dead. And then a week later, our carpet cleaner comes at our door, and he's wearing a mask. And I give him a hard time. I say, hey, don't you know if you take the vaccine, you don't have to wear a mask? And he said, well, I wasn't able to take both shots. And I said, why not? He said, well, after the first shot, 2 minutes after the first shot, he had a heart attack. And he spent the night in the hospital, and he has never been the same since that time. And so that was the wake-up call for me when I saw it happening in my own personal circle, because I was believing the whole narrative. I was selling the whole narrative until this guy shows up at my door to clean my carpet, saying he had a heart attack 2 minutes after he got the shot, and he's never been the same. And his wife had symptoms too. So that's what led me to start to look and see somebody's lying to me, and I don't think it's my friends. And so I started looking at the various data. I looked at all sorts of data. I looked at every piece of data I could lay my hands on, and it was all the same. It was all showing that these shots are causing a level of adverse events as well as death, morbidity and mortality. Beyond anything that's ever been seen before.
Wait, can I ask you to pause right there? So, you're describing pure intellectual inquiry motivated by, you know, curiosity and concern, which is great. But you're also doing this in a context, and the context is the spring of 2021, where you are not allowed to question the vaccine if you want to remain friends with people, if you want to be considered a serious person, if you don't want to be trashed on Wikipedia as you have been. And so you spend your whole life gathering accolades, going to, you know, impressive schools, making a ton of money, being celebrated in the press. And you must know on some level, because you're smart, that if you start talking about this stuff, all of that is over and you're going to be a thought criminal and people are going to look at you sideways. Did you know that?
No, I had no idea. I thought that if I told the truth and I let people know about the facts and the data that I had uncovered, that people would basically say, oh, you're right. This looks like a big problem. We need to stop the shots. And I told my wife after you know, before I did this, I said, hey, this will be over in like 2 weeks. I mean, yeah. If the data is so clear that this is going to be done in 2 weeks, and we're still at it after all this time.
So tell us what you found and what you have found and what your conclusions are.
Well, what I found was all the data was consistent with this vaccine being the most dangerous vaccine of all time. I mean, there are more reports on this vaccine in the VAERS system, which is the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. It's the official system for reporting adverse events for a vaccine. It's set up by the U.S. government. It's run by the U.S. government. And there are more reports for the COVID vaccine than for all vaccines in history combined. And not only that, but we found out later that this VAERS system, which they set up to monitor for safety, had triggered 770 different safety signals. Now, normally, a vaccine only will trigger zero safety signals. It'd be really unusual for a vaccine to trigger any safety signals in VAERS, especially because the way they define these safety signals makes it almost impossible for a vaccine to trigger a safety signal. But this vaccine triggered 770 safety signals. So what did the CDC do about it? They basically told no one. The only reason that we even found out about it is because someone issued a Freedom of Information Act request to the CDC requesting, could you show me the output of the analysis of the safety signal analysis you're supposed to do? And so they got back a spreadsheet showing 770 safety signals were triggered. That is mind-blowing. That is not a 3-alarm fire. That is a 770-alarm fire.
Wow. This is absolutely mind-blowing. And, you know, the interview goes on. I invite you to check it out. But, you know, that's not all. You can't believe what's coming out in the media and social media. Let's go over to former CNN anchor Chris Cuomo. And remember, he was released from CNN during the controversy with his brother, Andrew Cuomo. And in my book, Courage to Face COVID-19, we have a chapter 11. Hope everybody has the book. And the title of the book, John Leake put, was Cuomo Sexuals. And it really had to do with this great controversy that Andrew Cuomo, who won an Emmy Award for his command and control press conferences during the pandemic, but the disastrous decision of having sick patients return to nursing homes infect more patients, and the mortality in New York State nursing homes skyrocketed. Then he is brought off stage, taken out of public view with probably a contrived sexual affair, sexual harassment case. Chris Cuomo goes down with him. Chris has reemerged on News Nation. Now, he had COVID early. He was in lockdown. Then he was promoting the vaccines. And he decides to bring on his personal doctor to discuss a recent report from the Global Vaccine Safety Network, which on its surface, this paper tries to minimize the COVID-19 vaccine safety concerns, but in reality is showing really significant problems. Let's listen to Cuomo and his doctor. I think it's very, very enlightening.
The largest COVID vaccine study to date was just released. 99 million people from around the world. It found that there is an extremely rare but increased risk for certain neurological, heart, blood, and brain disorders after taking the vaccine. But how rare is okay? And how much more is it now identified in people than before the vaccine? And also, what about all the long COVID symptoms that people are presenting? Why didn't they ask the 99 million about that? Those are all really good questions, right? You know how I know? They're not mine. They come from my doctor, double board certified physician, long COVID clinical specialist at Terrain Health, Dr. Robin Rose. So you called me about this and said, boy, the headline makes it sound like you got nothing to worry about. The opposite is true. Why?
So the background of the study is that they looked at, like you said, these 99 million people across 10 sites, 8 countries, and they identified these very significant problems that were neurologic, cardiac, or hematologic issues. But these are problems that with any therapeutic or vaccine that is coming out, you wouldn't want to see these issues, right? Or you wouldn't expect to see these issues. And if you did, you'd want to see them at a low rate. And there were a handful that were flagged, you know, as safety signals that were 2 to 3 times higher, you know, when they looked at, they were, you know, they had the expected versus what the observed outcomes would be. And they were 2 to 3 times higher anyway.
So wait, what does that mean? What does expected versus observed mean?
So when you're rolling out, you know, a therapeutic, a treatment, a vaccine, you know, you expect maybe you'll have some side effects, mild, moderate, or severe side effects. So when they saw, you know, when they were looking at the data, they knew that some of the side effects, that these serious side effects, the outcomes that were observed by the data collected by these 99 million people were higher than what they had expected. Does that make sense?
Mm. Yeah. And you told me that as an analogy, you were like, if we were talking about like cancers or things like that, people would not be happy about what they're seeing in this study. How so?
So this is what I mean. So when the headlines come out about vaccine, right, versus COVID, the vaccine, it's downplayed in a lot of ways, or the headlines downplay what's happening. Okay. And the issue is that in our society and in healthcare in general, we always do care about the few or the rare things that happen, right? So, you know, we colon cancer screen everyone that's 45 years and older, you know, in the hundreds of thousands or millions of people that need to get screened, because we're worried about the 32 out of every 100,000 people that get it per year, right? Same thing with women and cervical cancer. You know, 7.7 females out of every 100,000 per year get cervical cancer. These are rarer, fewer events that occur, but we care about them. We don't downplay them, and we screen these people, and we try to prevent it from happening. That was my point.
And here we're saying it's an acceptable loss. And you made another good point to me, which is, why didn't they, if they had this big cohort to work with, why didn't they ask them about a lot of other things that clinicians like you are seeing and see how prevalent they are? Well, what do you think the answer to your own question is?
Right. So exactly. There's tens of millions of people out there that are screaming from the rooftop saying that after they had the vaccine, they have suffered just, you know, basic symptoms, or not that basic, but not as severe as this, but symptoms that have impaired their activities of daily living. You know, they can't live the way they used to live on a daily basis. And those are things including, you know, chest heaviness, you know, persistent headaches every day, brain fog, post-exertional malaise, neuropathy, weakness, new onset cardiac arrhythmias, structural heart damage, autoimmune conditions, all these different things. I can name 100 other things probably. You know, why are we not looking at those things? The things that we are looking at in this study particularly are things that are super rare and very, very serious and life-threatening.
Last thing. My producer just got in my ear, Ben, and said, hey, you know, the studies suggest that if you were vaccinated, you're less likely to get long COVID. Is that true in your experience?
In our personal experience, what we're seeing is that's a mixed bag. It's a mixed bag. We need a lot more data on that, but it seems that many patients that had long COVID that got vaccinated actually got worse instead of better. In my experience, and in a lot of my colleagues' experience that are taking care of these patients across the country. So I think that really has to be looked at a little closer. And Chris, there was a study too that just came out about pregnant women last week. And when you look at that study, over 51% of the women that were pregnant that went on to have long COVID were vaccinated. And 49%, so there it was a little bit more, you know, hedged more towards those patients, right, were vaccinated and went on to long COVID versus not. So this is something that again, is multifactorial. There's multiple things at play. People have had multiple vaccines and multiple exposures to the virus.
Good news is the largest COVID vaccine study.
Wow. So you can see what's going on now from Tucker Carlson, former Fox primetime evening anchor, to Chris Cuomo, former CNN primetime evening anchor in the United States, that finally news is coming out regarding the vaccines, and unfortunately it's not good. Even Chris Cuomo's producer trying to spin it in his ear, saying, wait a minute, doesn't the vaccine reduce long COVID? And then his doctor comes out and honestly says, no, it doesn't. In fact, it makes it worse. And, you know, that's been my experience. And the published science paper by Diexner and colleagues from Germany, 48,000 Germans, is pretty clear. COVID-19 vaccination doesn't reduce long COVID. It makes it worse. In fact, COVID-19 vaccine brings on the symptoms of long COVID. So this is such a revealing time where I think no matter where one is in the popular media, in the scientific realm, public policy, or in industry, school, and general life, people are coming around to the bottom line that the COVID-19 vaccines are simply not safe. They haven't been proven to be safe. And boy, people are now recognizing it. There's no doubt about it. There's a report out on Twitter, and you'll see it this week. It's been put forward by Dr. David Cartland, who's a United Kingdom emergency room doctor. And these data come from the UK government statistics on vaccine uptake in frontline healthcare workers. But I can tell you right now that the seasonal COVID-19 booster was taken up by only 30.6 of frontline healthcare workers in the UK. It means basically 70% refused the booster. Now, among doctors, that number was 39.5% took the booster. Qualified nurses, less, 28.4%. Clinical staff, 35.6%, support staff, 26.6%. So in the United Kingdom, the vast majority of frontline workers, doctors, qualified nurses, clinical staff, and support staff are not taking boosters. That should tell you something. The feedback on Twitter, I was kind of amazed with the dialogue. The feedback on Twitter was said, well, if they're declining the boosters, why are they encouraging them among their patients? And are they encouraging among their patients? So this and so much more to sort out. Lots of activity in the legal sphere. A report in from the Kansas Senate passed a pair of public health bills tied to COVID-19. They limit the power of public health officials and guarantee in-person visits to hospitals patients cannot be denied care in the setting of a pandemic. Very, very important. We have the International COVID Summit going on in Washington, and presenters, I think the big news there was Kevin McKernan was on stage presenting data on the DNA process-related impurities that are in the messenger RNA, Pfizer and Moderna COVID-19 vaccines. It is clearly coming out that the vaccines were never inspected for these impurities. They're above the levels that are acceptable in terms of quantity and length of fragment. Remember, the DNA process-related impurities can be the antibiotic-resistant gene in the plasmid, and then simian virus 40, SV40, promoter, enhancer, and origin of insertion, which are known proto-oncogene activators. It was this finding that prompted Florida Surgeon General Dr. Joe Ladapo to write the CDC and FDA and said, please clarify this, inspect the vials, tell us what's going on. They refused to do so. So Ladapo joined a chorus now of calls, including mine, to remove the COVID-19 vaccines from the market. Many now are getting into the fray. Russell Brand, who's a podcaster, comedian from the UK, hosted on his show Pierre Corey. Dr. Meryl Nass, Member of Parliament Andrew Brigden, fully getting out this biopharmaceutical complex censorship activity that's going on all over the world now. People being harmed greatly because of censorship. And then, I'll give you my news. And that is, I am senior author on a paper in Curious. And I've just tweeted this out. This paper titled COVID-19 Messenger RNA Vaccines, Lessons Learned from the Registrational Trials and Global Vaccine Campaign. This is the number one ranked paper on the Springer Nature Curious Journal of Medical Sciences. And this paper has an SIQ rating, which is a quotient of how good the article is, of 9.3. And the Curious says anything greater than 9.2 is considered excellent and groundbreaking. It's based on the clarity of background and rationale, the clinical significance, the study design and methods, the data analysis, novelty of conclusions, and quality of presentations. At the time of this recording, it had 330,840 total article reads, and that included 12,400 PDF downloads from the site. Does not include the National Library of Medicine downloads. Those will come in next month. And this paper, which is a very detailed, evidence-based paper that carefully reviews all the clinical trial data. It also reviews the post-marketing data. Now, it does focus on Pfizer, since Pfizer's data are most widely disclosed regarding their clinical trial dossier. And, of course, focuses on more broadly the post-marketing data on all the COVID-19 vaccines. This paper has an extraordinary evidence base. And it went through, it had probably a dozen peer reviewers, had hundreds of comments that had to be addressed. And, it cites 293 references. As I mentioned, 330,840 total reads, views, downloads. That compares to, and that was over a month, that compares to 2,700 on average for a Curious journal over the course of a year. Nathaniel Mead is the first author. He is a former NIH epidemiologist. The authors also include MIT professor Stephanie Senoff, Rolf Wollinger, Jessica Rose, a viral epidemiologist, Chris Denharchiak, Steve Kirsch, and myself. This paper was actually targeted by several internet trolls, they kept putting comments on the paper, creating problems for it with the publisher. Then Tim Kirsches got involved. He's a research integrity advisor who looks very junior. He's got a background in philosophy from University of Groningen, and he worked at several NGOs, and he works as a research integrity advisor to Springer. He basically has retracted the paper. We got the notice on February 23rd, and he indicates that after an extensive rebuttal, that we rebutted 8 points. He brought up 8 points that had already been addressed through this extensive peer review process regarding our citations and our support for the conclusions that were drawn. He said this, the quote, "The editors-in-chief have retracted this article following publication concerns were raised and raised by these two internet trolls, Doppler and Laxton, regarding a number of claims made in the article. Upon further review, the editors-in-chief found that the conclusions of this narrative review are considered to be unreliable due to the concerns with the validity of some of the cited references that support the conclusions and a misrepresentation of the cited references and available data." Essentially, just gobbledygook, not citing really anything that would fulfill the COPE guidelines. What were the conclusions of the paper? The paper concluded the COVID-19 vaccines should be pulled off the market. So Kirsches is in violation of the COPE guidelines for retraction. This is a fully peer-reviewed, accepted, copyrighted, published manuscript that's been part of medical history now for a month. The Committee on Publication Ethics, COPE, guidelines state that retractions should be considered if the following points are hit. The first point, they have clear evidence that the findings are unreliable, either the result of a major error, miscalculation, result of fabrication, or falsification. Next point, it constitutes plagiarism. Next point, findings have been previously published elsewhere. Next point, contains material data without authorization for use. Next point, copyright has been infringed. Next point, reports unethical research. Next point, has been published solely on the basis of compromised or manipulated peer review process. Next point, the authors failed to disclose a major competing interest. None of these COPE points were fulfilled for Kirchez to withdraw our paper. And I think the issue at hand is who pressured Springer Nature from an external perspective to pull our paper. We knew two internet trolls, Doppler and Laxton, were on this paper commenting relentlessly. They've been linked to NGOs who are part of this biopharmaceutical complex, but it looks like a biopharmaceutical complex takedown of a major publication that had concluded that the COVID-19 vaccines should be pulled off the market. We'll pick up on this on the other side. You're listening to the McCullough Report. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report, and I'm Dr. Peter McCullough.
Cholesterol, blood pressure, blood sugar, inflammation, and weight. These are all real-world problems that 87% of Americans are struggling with. Often, there are no symptoms, but left unattended, we become inundated with one health problem after another. It's time to fight back with HealRight. HealRight is a bar that you eat, but it's food as medicine that addresses the nutritional root cause of health issues in just 8 weeks. Developed by world-renowned scientists and backed by 15 years of research, HealRight is effective, but it's also delicious and works without additional diet or lifestyle changes. Step out of the statistics and use food as medicine. Visit HealRight.com/outloud or AmericaOutloud.shop and use the code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
Cardiovascular disease is the leading cause of death and disability. Lifestyle changes are critical, but you can also support your heart with concentrated nutrients. Healthy Cell created heart and vascular health to support cholesterol and blood pressure with CoQ10, vitamin K2, resveratrol, and soluble fiber. And Healthy Cell's not a pill. It's a patent-pending gel you swallow. Get heart healthy. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order. HealthyCell.com. Code OUTLOUD for 25% off.
Who's got time for a nasal invasion messing up your lifestyle? Crush those nasties before they become a problem. For a limited time, when you add the new Cofix RX throat spray to your order with the coupon code OUTLOUD, you'll receive 20% off the entire purchase. Go to AmericaOutloud.shop. That's AmericaOutloud.shop. And use coupon code OUTLOUD.
Use Cofix RX because it works.
World-class care from doctors you can trust, all from the comfort of your home. That is One Wellness. Dr. Peter McCullough and his team at The Wellness Company designed the One Wellness membership to provide free monthly supplements and unlimited telemedicine access with doctors that share your values. Go to OutLoudCare.com today and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first month of One Wellness.
Well, the year 2024 must be the year of the Patriot, and AmericaOutloud.news will equip you with all the information you need to give new meaning to the words Patriot Act. For our actions always ultimately define our words. Now is our time, my fellow Americans. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report. And I'm Dr. Peter McCullough. So what's the next step? What are we going to do with this paper? Nathaniel Mead, epidemiologist, former employee at the National Institutes of Health. I can tell you our next move is to, again, take this out to the peer-reviewed literature. We're likely going to leverage one of the preprint servers and then publish it to the best extent we can, recovering from this retraction. The paper has clearly been out. It's influenced the literature greatly. It's influenced people's opinions regarding the COVID-19 vaccines, and we can't get away from this. The COVID-19 vaccine data continues to mount record numbers of injuries, disabilities, and deaths. Four major areas: cardiovascular, including myocarditis, acceleration of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, cardiac arrhythmias, sudden death, cardiac arrest. There, we have now a very solid paper. First author is Holscher and colleagues. I'm the senior author, looking at all the autopsies. This was published in the European Society of Cardiology. It's now very clear that those individuals who take the vaccine and suddenly die, that in fact, they have, on a more probable than not basis, that they have died of the COVID-19 vaccine. That's now autopsy proven in one of the best peer-reviewed journals in cardiology. It's also received record downloads from that journal, exceeding any other paper in the last 2 years, and it's was obviously withstood peer review. And so make sure you check out that paper. Holscher is the first author, Hodkinson, a pathologist, a second author, Mackus, internist, third author, and then myself as the senior author, European Society of Cardiology, Heart Failure 2024. Another very important paper, Jessica Rose, first author, Nick Holscher, University of Michigan, second author, myself as a senior author, on myocarditis, discussing the determinants of COVID-19 vaccine-induced myocarditis. This is an analysis, a direct data analysis from VAERS that clearly demonstrated that the reports on myocarditis after COVID-19 vaccination in 2021 were 223 times higher than the average of all vaccines combined over the last 30 years, represented a 2,500% increase in the absolute number of reports in the first year of the campaign compared to historical values. You know, rarely a flu vaccine could cause myocarditis. By the way, a smallpox or monkeypox vaccine has done that too. Demographic data revealed that myocarditis mostly occurred in youths and males. A total of 76% of cases resulted in emergency care and hospitalization. Of the total myocarditis reports, 93 individuals died. That was a 3% case fatality rate. It was more common after dose 2, and individuals less than age 30 were more likely than those over age 30 to develop acute myocarditis. This was published in Therapeutic Advances of Drug Safety in 2024. These, again, fully accepted, peer-reviewed, copyrighted, and published papers that you can examine yourself regarding COVID-19 vaccine safety, and you can share with your loved ones if they still remain skeptical of our concerns regarding COVID-19 vaccine safety. Now, beyond the cardiovascular domain, and that's where the autopsy data suggests most of the deaths are cardiovascular, the next big area of concern is neurologic. There we have a stroke, acute ischemic or hemorrhagic stroke of great concern, Guillain-Barré syndrome, small fiber neuropathy, hearing loss, vision loss, all reported after COVID-19 vaccination, examination of the retina showing micro-blood clotting occurring in the retinal arteries and veins, suggesting systemic micro-blood clotting. The third major area is thrombosis, blood clots, both arterial and venous, some of the largest blood clots we've ever seen. There, a paper by Wu and colleagues, not just focused on the Janssen vaccine, but I can tell you that Janssen is nearly identical to the AstraZeneca vaccine, very similar to the Sputnik vaccine in Russia. I can tell you that Wu works for the U.S. FDA and published an evaluation of thrombosis, and this is very important, a paper on thrombosis that clearly outlined a striking number of serious thrombosis cases in patients who had received the Janssen vaccine in the United States. Its analog would be the AstraZeneca vaccine outside the United States. They described blood clots that occurred in thousands of individuals that extended from the ankle to the hip. Again, this is the U.S. FDA. And in that paper, there was a clear-cut mortality rate associated with this. And the mortality rate was approximately 11%. So we have great alarm coming from all over the, all over the world now regarding blood clots in COVID-19 vaccination. Fourth major area is immunologic. There, the blood tests that we're measuring in clinical practice are the ANA, the anti-nuclear antibody, the ANCA, the anti-neutrophil cytoplasmic antibody, the anti-citrullinated peptide, and the rheumatoid factor. Those four blood tests are now core as an autoimmune check. Autoimmune syndromes can arise after COVID-19 vaccination at any time. It's been my experience that it takes a few years after the vaccine for autoimmunity to turn on, implying that the messenger RNA is still at work producing spike protein being produced on the cell surface, triggering autoimmunity over time. We could pick public figures for each and every one of these categories of complications, just so you could try to put it in perspective. Let's take myocarditis. There we have a former Tampa Bay Bucks coach, Bruce Arians, pushing the vaccine on the players in 2021. The only way to come back is to have all the Bucks staff and coaches fully vaccinated. Arians presumably takes the vaccine and then spends a month or more in the hospital with COVID-19 vaccine-induced myocarditis, showing that it can occur at older age ranges. I mean, that's just an example right there. We have basketball player Oscar Cabrera Adames, who doesn't want to take the vaccine. 2021, he takes the vaccine. He plays in the European leagues. He's from Dominican Republic. He has a vaccine cardiac arrest on the floor during a basketball game. He's resuscitated. He survives. He blames the vaccine for his cardiac arrest, and then he goes on to try to recover. In 2023, he dies on a medical treadmill test, showing that death can occur after COVID-19 vaccine-induced myocarditis even a couple years later. That's in the cardiovascular category. In the neurologic category, we have a multitude of examples. Let me just give you a couple. Justin Bieber. Bieber develops Ramsey-Hunt syndrome, a classic vaccine injury syndrome, and it affects his eye. It affects the seventh nerve. It's a reactivation of the varicella-zoster virus. He must have not gotten early treatment. And to this day, Bieber has not returned to touring. His wife, Hailey Bieber, presumably takes the vaccine, has a blood clot. It traverses a small hole in the heart known as a patent foramen ovale and becomes a thrombotic stroke. And she has to have an intervention to try to reduce the stroke damage. These are young people. Let's take an older person. Again, presumably vaccinated, former U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein develops neuroinvasive varicella-zoster meningoencephalitis. That is invasive zoster that invades her brain and kills her. and kills her. I mean, that's an example. Another example in the neurologic category, someone who I knew and met, and I told him it wasn't safe, and that's Jamie Foxx. Jamie Foxx presumably, again, takes the vaccine and develops a stroke. He's in the hospital. He claims to have tubes in him, probably feeding gastrostomy and tracheostomy tubes over a period of time. Fortunately, he's starting to recover. And the list can go on and on and on in terms of neurologic. Thrombotic, a public figure there is Kirk Herbstreit, an ESPN announcer. He gets COVID-19 early, has long COVID syndrome, gets through it, unwisely takes the vaccine, develops deep venous thrombosis and pulmonary embolism, which markedly limits his ability to do his broadcasting work during parts of the football season. Happened to my favorite weatherman, TV weatherman Al Roker. Now, he takes the vaccine early. He takes it with a doctor on TV, presumably takes multiple shots, has COVID-19. Then he develops blood clots and pulmonary embolism, showing that the DVT and PE can occur directly after the vaccine, but also can occur after COVID-19 in a vaccinated person because the vaccines don't work. They don't stop COVID. With all of these public figures, they quickly become silent now on the vaccine. The final thrombotic example is former Dallas Cowboy player and football phenom Deion Sanders, who's now the current coach of the University of Colorado football team. He had prior toe amputation from a problem when he played for Dallas Cowboys and claims to have a family history of a clotting disorder, maybe even familial peripheral vascular disease. But indeed, he's pushing the vaccine, just like Bruce Arians. And then Deion Sanders presents with an arterial venous thrombotic syndrome, nearly loses his leg, has multiple amputations, multiple procedures, is in a wheelchair on the sidelines for a while, loses a tremendous amount of weight, and finally starts to come back. He's not going to run the same as Neon Deion as we remember him. So a tremendous number of examples of thrombotic complications. So many suffering blood clots on blood thinners. I've never prescribed so many blood thinners in my life. It's been my experience that the blood clots are very slow to resolve, that we have to use McCullough protocol-based spike protein detoxification. That is the blood thinning and really thrombolytic capabilities of nattokinase, the blood thinning abilities of bromelain, in addition to our traditional, what's called novel anticoagulants, or even warfarin. When patients are antiplatelet antibody positive, we end up going to warfarin. So some patients after the vaccine now are on this most serious and most difficult to use blood thinner of all time, that is warfarin or Coumadin. An example of the fourth major area of autoimmune syndromes. Remember a paper by Panagis Polycritis, senior author on it. Polycritis said, listen, everybody who takes the vaccine to some degree is going to have autoimmune problems because the genetic vaccines, messenger RNA vaccines, install the genetic code. The human ribosomes read it inside the cells. They express a foreign protein on the cell surface. Then the body attacks its own cells. So by definition, it's creating autoimmunity in each and every one of us who've taken the vaccine. And indeed, one could actually look at this and say, well, how is this going to manifest? We have some crude markers of autoimmunity, but they're serious. The antinuclear antibody test is the the first entry autoimmunity test we do in reflexive testing for systemic lupus erythematosus, for mixed connective tissue disease, scleroderma, a whole variety of problems, the rheumatoid factor, an anti-citrullinated peptide map to rheumatoid arthritis. And then the ANCA, the anti-nuclear cytoplasmic antibody, that maps to serious vasculitis, that is serious skin rashes associated with renal failure. Well, the celebrity there is Megyn Kelly, former primetime anchor, multiple major TV stations. Now she's in independent media. Wow, she comes out and says that she has an autoimmune condition after taking the vaccine. She mentions it in multiple interviews. She goes on Dr. Drew's show, Drew Pinsky's show. And also, she ultimately is interviewing with President Trump former President Trump, and she confronts Trump on the problems that she's had after COVID-19 vaccination. So it's always been my theory that when public figures ultimately came out or it became so abundantly apparent that they have problems with COVID-19 vaccination, that we may see capitulation. However, the biopharmaceutical complex is still very strong. They're fighting at tooth and nail, using every tool of censorship humanly possible to try to suppress the message that the COVID-19 vaccines are neither safe nor effective. That's the truth. They didn't work. We're 4 years now or longer into the pandemic, 3 years or longer into the vaccine campaign, and we still see cases of COVID. What can we do about it? McCullough Protocol base spike protein detoxification is the only published protocol that gives a suggestion of what to do. Now, we don't have large prospective randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trials to prove that this reduces the intensity and severity of long COVID syndrome symptoms or post-vaccine injury syndromes, what we collectively call post-acute sequelae. We don't have the proof because there's never been any funding for this. There are no registered trials of using this approach. In fact, the President Biden HHS Long COVID Research Program has spent $1 billion and it's generated no new drugs, no protocols of existing drugs, nor any suggestions of what we can do for acute COVID-19 patients. So Dr. Brian Proctor and myself in my office published the first paper suggesting this approach in the Journal of American Physician and Surgeons. It was on the Zenodo European Commission preprint server. And then we fully published the approach with some additional suggestion on therapeutics in the Springer Nature Curious Journal. So here we go again. Are we going to face censorship on this paper? I do have to think that we should be braced to do this. Nick Hulscher from University of Michigan, he's going to be a future McCullough Foundation fellow. Nick was an author on this paper, helped bring it over the finish line. What does it suggest? That patients with post-acute sequelae after multiple episodes of COVID-19 or vaccination or both, that they take nattokinase, which is an enzyme derived from the fermentation of soy by a bacteria called Bacillus subtilis natto. The Japanese eat this as a breakfast food. It's typically not palatable to the English tongue, but they eat it. They've been doing so for its cardiovascular benefits for over 1,000 years. It's been available as a capsule now for several decades. Nattokinase, a simple over-the-counter supplement, 2,000 fibrinolytic units twice a day, and that's a starting dose. Can go much higher. Studies have used, 10,000 units a day. So we start low, work our way high. Second component to McCullough Protocol based spike protein detoxification is bromelain. Bromelain is a family of enzymes derived from the stems of pineapples. Bromelain, like nattokinase, has been shown to help dissolve the spike protein. That's the problem from recurrent episodes of COVID and from the vaccine. The human body has the Wuhan spike protein in it, and our bodies can't clear it out. Bromelain, the dose is 500 milligrams once a day. Again, the dose can be escalated. And then the third component is curcumin, derived from turmeric, the Indian spice. Curcumin, multiple anti-inflammatory properties. Now, curcumin has actually been brought all the way forward to human randomized trials in patients with long COVID, and it clearly works. It reduces inflammation. Probably doesn't help dissolve the spike protein, but it reduces inflammation. The problem with curcumin is not well absorbed, so we combine it with black pepper extract, which is called biopurine or piperine, and a dose of about 5 milligrams to 10 milligrams per dose of curcumin. Now, this is widely available on Amazon, on any natural food store, any online natural supplement retailer. And this is very affordable. No restrictions to you on this. A very popular purveyor of the triple combination, is termed the ultimate spike detox, is the Wellness Company. Those of you know me well, I advise a wellness company on a part-time basis as a chief scientific officer. The Wellness Company form of nattokinase is called Spike Support, and Spike Support has nattokinase, very high quality, U.S. sourced, with five minor ingredients that all have scientific rationale where they could help the nattokinase. And then in addition, we add separately the bromelain and the curcumin. So we use McCullough protocol-based spike protein detoxification. It's been our observation now. We have thousands of patients under observation. I'm communicating with other doctors around the world. We're talking 3, 6, 12 months of detoxification to start to make improvements, start to have numbness and tingling, ringing in the ears, heart palpitations, all these common symptoms finally dissipate over time. Now, it's in our practice and in the paper published by Hosher and colleagues in the journal Curious, we outline that a common practice of ours, if there are any pleural or pericardial symptoms, we add colchicine. Colchicine is a prescription drug. It inhibits microtubule formation in white blood cells. It was a mainstay during COVID-19 because of the cold corona trial, and about 19 other trials showed colchicine benefited patients who were acutely ill with COVID-19. So we added in these syndromes. It's a gold standard, by the way, for the treatment of myopericarditis. So it covers that base. Very worried about patients with myopericarditis being untreated, undetected, and having a cardiac arrest. So you'll see us use a lot of colchicine in patients with post-acute sequelae after the infection, after the vaccine. Another commonly used drug is hydroxychloroquine. If any one of those four autoimmune markers are positive, we use hydroxychloroquine. Very important. Again, probably 3 to 6 months or more. Hydroxychloroquine, also a gold standard for multi-system inflammatory disorder, MIS, occurring typically in young people after multiple rounds of COVID illness. And then the last two drugs I'd say that are commonly used, if there are cutaneous syndromes, sloughing, an urticarial rash, dermatographia, in my experience, ivermectin plays a role, probably residual SARS-CoV-2 replication and activation of immunoglobulin E and mast cell destabilization. Ivermectin, 0.6 milligrams per kilogram, typically for 90 days. And then if patients have brain fog, listlessness, lack of energy, one paper supports it, and our clinical observations show this definitely works, is to use a nicotine patch. Nicotine patch at 7 milligrams a day for non-smokers can help greatly. It's very safe, prescription or over-the-counter. Smokers, we typically go up to 14 or 21 milligrams at that dose. So that's McCullough protocol-based spike protein detoxification with some add-ons, including some of the prescription pharmaceuticals. People have said, well, Dr. McCullough, can we use N-acetylcysteine? Can we use vitamin C? I said, sure you can. You can add to McCullough protocol-based spike protein detoxification. I don't think any of these other suggestions replaces the core of nattokinase, bromelain, and curcumin, but they could be helpful adding it to the base. Just like with the treatment of acute COVID-19, the treatment of post-acute sequelae after SARS-CoV-2 infection and after the vaccine is a multi-drug, multi-agent program, a regimen to get people better and get them back on their feet again. Well, I'm Dr. Peter McCullough. Thank you so much for listening to the show. We'll be back next week with more news, more updates, and things that help you in your lives. Thank you so much for your loyal following and listening. Make sure you follow me on social media. Go to petermcculloughmd.com. That'll take you everywhere. I'm just about going to top 1 million followers on Twitter. Why doesn't everybody get on Twitter? Retweet me, follow me, P_McCulloughMD. I'll report back to you next week. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is a McCullough Report.